This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. So we're here with our special episode for Mental Health Awareness Week here in the UK, now that we are halfway through it. How are you finding the week so far? That's a mean question because it's actually Monday when we're recording it.
Yeah.
Danielle's looking very scared. How do you think your week is going to be?
Yeah, it's Monday, so I've had a half a morning. So far, so good. Looking forward to this amazing weather. Enjoying this amazing weather, should I say. The sunshine just makes me feel amazing. And so I'm looking forward to that. Although it does bring, Mummy, where can we get the pool out? Mummy, can we get the tent out? Mummy, can we do this? Can we do that? I'm like, no, you're doing maths and English today. We've got schoolwork to do. So the sun distracts us all. It's the same with myself, though, you know, wanting to do work. And then the sun's like, come out here. Get your sundress on. Come out here. So, yeah, I love it, but it's a little bit bittersweet.
Yeah, I get that. I think it's going to be a really nice week, not only in weather, but also just... It actually feels like we're sort of back to normal in that we're going to be so busy this week that it makes up for all the work we can't do because, you know, every Mental Health Awareness Week, we've always got loads on. And it's lovely to see that even in the middle of the pandemic, that's not being forgotten.
Yeah.
Obviously, our main focus is mental health. And right now, understandably, the globe's focus is on physical health, specifically this one condition. And that makes sense and it's understandable, but it's important not to forget mental health and all the huge impact that these prevention measures and indeed the pandemic itself is having. Yeah, so I'm really pleased to be doing our bit to get that content out there to reach as many people as possible. And we're doing loads of fun collaborations this week, as always, to destigmatize mental health in what is an incredibly challenging time. And therefore, in many ways, we need good, positive, hopeful messages. And so that's very much what this episode's about, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Before that, a few things to mention that are keeping us busy. So this week on Tuesday, an episode of Off Radar podcast is coming out where I am the guest. It was a really good chat. It's possibly one of the best conversations I've had about mental health ever.
Wow.
And to be fair, a lot of that is, it can be a lot easier to just be raw and really open and really clear when I'm not also trying to juggle formatting my own show and remembering what my next question is. So I think it's just a really open-hearted conversation, and James that hosted it did a brilliant job. At times he wasn't quite sure, because we went quite deep, you know, how to ask certain questions or what the right thing to say is. But I think there can be a lot learned from that in people doing their best and approaching it with kindness as best as they can.
Yeah, and a real authenticity to that. And I think that's amazing. I'm really pleased, Bob, because you do. You interview all our guests and it's always very structured and you do such a good job, but you do juggle everything. And so I'm really looking forward to listening to it and for you to be, obviously, we have our own conversations off air, of which obviously I've dropped down from being the best ever mental health conversation you've ever had. So I'm not thinking about that. You know, I'm not going to lie. When you first said it to me, I was a bit like, my eyes were like twitching a bit. I was a bit like, oh, okay. No, of course I wasn't. Yeah, I'm really pleased that the listeners can tune into that and get to hear you and, you know, a bit of insight into Bobby.
Yeah, true. I share a lot of my background and a lot of the barriers I had to overcome personally. But the more I've learned to speak about that, the more I found how universal that is. That a lot of my issues were around man-up culture, gender expectation, lack of education on mental illness. All of these things led to me getting support much, much later than when the symptoms first cropped up. In some cases, 1-2 decades after. So I'm really glad to have learned through, I guess, this process of doing what I can to take away stigma for others. I've learned how much my story can connect. So I think there'll be a lot there for listeners. So there'll be a link for that in the episode description today. So I guess that's what you've got instead of one of our normal episodes today, with today obviously being a special episode and something a bit different. Also, we have a surprise collaboration coming up as well. So do keep an eye on our social media for that, which you can find again in the episode description. And not by coincidence, in this intro, we've been using the word kindness because that is the theme for Mental Health Awareness Week this year. It was actually changed as a result of the pandemic. And I think that was a really good move because right now, as we've discussed, the focus on kindness and the need for it is so apparent right now. And that's been really lovely to see, this renewed focus on altruism and the ways in which other people are struggling. Many of these struggles, like of course mental health struggles, aren't new for a lot of us. Just what's going on right now is complicating our lives or making them more difficult. So I think the Mental Health Foundation focusing specifically on kindness for the campaign this year is really positive. And yeah, really looking forward to seeing what comes out of that.
Same. And it's quite interesting that I think we've seen so much kindness, you know, as you mentioned that throughout this, it's been in abundance, whether it's to your next door neighbour, whether it's to work colleagues, whoever, strangers, people are being kind all over the place. I think it's brilliant. It seems really relevant that it's a theme. And that my daughter said to me when I told them that it's Mental Health Awareness Week, girls, and the theme is kindness. And Ella said, but Mummy, you always say we have to be kind. Why do we have to be kind just this week?
Oh,
I know.
I love that.
I know. I thought, well, you don't have to just be kind this week, actually. I had to explain this then to a 9 and 6-year-old when we're having like campaigns and then what that means for a week. But I've always told them, you know, to lead with kindness. It's so important to me. You get so much back in return. Yeah, it's important for our family. So I'm really pleased that it's a theme this week.
Yeah, I love that so many of your stories about your kids is them holding you accountable for things.
Always.
Which is really lovely. It's definitely a selling point. But, you know, I think as they get older, it gets more complicated.
Yeah.
And, you know, these rules are like set in stone. I remember with my mum, we weren't allowed chewing gum growing up. And now she constantly has it. And apparently she did the whole time. She was just hiding it because she was like, I don't want you having it, but I'm used to having it. So I just had it in secret. Sometimes I'd have whole conversations with you where you'd like walked into a room unexpectedly. And it's like, I'm like not chewing or opening my mouth. So you don't realize. And I was like, wow, the conspiracy that was going on.
Yeah, that's what happens. I like the odd Coke, but my children don't drink fizzy drinks. So they will look at me every now and again and go, what's that? Especially the older one. But she's like, what are you drinking Coke for? I thought it was full of sugar. Yeah, well, it is. But so it's been right. They hold me accountable all the time. But yeah, I'm just pleased to keep pumping that message of kindness through to them. And, you know, even when it's hard to be.
Yeah.
It feels good.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure it will influence them. I mean, even being offered gum by my own mother. I still struggle to accept it now. I'm like, no, but it's wrong. So I'm sure they'll carry that kindness through with them. And I think that's a theme that's going to come through very much in today's episode called Hope from the Frontline, where we're featuring key workers sharing their experience of how the pandemic has affected their work, but also how they're finding hope and the reasons why they're still going to work and potentially putting themselves and their family, their community at risk, in order to help others and keep us all safe.
We're so excited about it, aren't we? They're all so good.
Yeah, we're really delighted. So it'll be a mixture of guests that we've previously had on the podcast and a few new people as well. And then we've got a special piece right at the end, which will keep us a surprise till then. And before we get into that, I believe there's something you wanted to give a quick plug to.
I do, and I'm not always one for plugging, but this is so important. I've recently become involved with the charity Shout, which is a crisis support charity, and it's a 24/7 text line for anybody to contact who feel that they are in mental health crisis. I wanted to just say, because I want it to reach more and more people, and with it being Mental Health Awareness Week, I think it's important that I give Shout a shout. The website is giveusashout.org, but more importantly, as I said, it's a text number and it's 85258, and you get qualified support at the end of the phone to help with anything that you're going through. It's an amazing charity, and it was launched by the Prince of Wales, William and Kate, and Meghan and Harry a year ago. They've just celebrated their first year anniversary. So please do share it and or use it accordingly if you feel that you need to.
I really love that. And I think it's a fun little plot twist for the episode already that, surprise, Danielle is now one of the frontline workers.
Yeah.
And I know that a big focus of that service is also people that are key workers, particularly those working in medicine, that are facing an unprecedented level of stress in their work environments. And so it's really great to hear that there's people out there like yourself who've gone through extensive training to support them and help them reflect and just process everything that's going on. All right, so with that all said, we'll get into Hope from the Frontline with some really incredible key workers. So first off is the secret psychiatrist, one of our all-time favourite guests, who has only recently been on one of our bonus lockdown interviews, sharing her advice for navigating your mental health during this pandemic and all the massive changes in our lives. In this clip, you'll hear her talk about how her work and her life has changed, but one thing that hasn't is how patients always come first. And even with the challenges she'll outline, they're keeping patients safe, they're keeping their services open. And I find her message really empowering around self-reflection and the little things we can all do to keep ourselves healthy and safe during this time.
Hi, I'm the secret psychiatrist, otherwise known as Dr. Pavinder Shergill. I'm a doctor that works in mental health in West London. I primarily work with CAMHS, so children and adolescents, but I also have the option to work in A&E, the geriatric wards, forensic wards, so those with a criminal background, acute wards and emergency wards as well. Since COVID-19, I think the world has completely changed, which I'm still trying to wrap my head around. I'm still going in. I've been lucky that I have been, you know, well enough to do my job. And I love it, despite these political issues with PPE. We don't have any at the moment. And the little that we do have in psychiatry, it's not effective PPE, essentially. So work has completely changed for me. We are trying to follow government policy similar to the GPs. Lots of people are working from home. That might be because they're unable to get in because of public transport, because they're at risk themselves. Also, if they need to protect loved ones that they're living with. So, and trying to do their consultation and reviews over the phone. Doctors are rotated to come into work. So at the moment, I'm scheduled to come in once a week and the rest of the time to do my consultations at home. That's a bit of a strange feeling, I think, as a doctor in psychiatry to do reviews on the phone, because 80% of it really is me looking at the patient, you know, watching how they react to me, the way they speak, their eye contact, their body language, their facial expressions, and also how they react to my body language as well. So it's very difficult to get that on a phone and for me to effectively and safely do my assessments and also medication reviews. None of us know medical legally where we stand about changing medications on a phone without seeing a patient. But patients always come first, no matter what's happening, despite COVID-19, that will never change. If we are concerned, if I'm ever concerned about someone's mental illness acutely, I will do a home visit. I will invite them in to see me in person, and I won't take that risk because end of the day, patients come first. And I will always do that, as we all will. I know people are really stressed in this time, and it's really hard for some people to self-isolate. And you might be self-isolating alone, or with people that can trigger your mental illness or make you feel worse, or it might be the complete opposite and you're really thriving in this time. But whatever it is, I really want everyone to know that we are here. The lines are not stopping. We are not forgetting about any of our patients. Even if you need to be referred, we will make that time. So please never let what's happening right now in the world stop that. Your health comes first. Always remember that. And there are lots of things you can do at home. People don't realize how amazing it is just to step outside and have the cold breeze on your face. It can do so much for you. Little things like that, having a little walk by yourself, listening to music, calling a friend, you know, FaceTiming a friend. These things can go so far. You don't have to physically be somewhere, and we're all in it together, which in a way I think is such a beautiful thing. The world is in this together, and that's so lovely in a way. So you're not alone. Everyone's there as well. If you have pets, I love pets. I think they make great therapy. You know, have fun with them. Painting, reading a book, really have this time for yourself and to reflect, because I don't think we're ever going to get this time again in life. So look at it in the positive way of what it could be. But again, if you need help, we are here. So don't worry about us. Don't worry about if we don't have PPE or if we're under stress. We're completely, honestly, we have this. This is what we're trained for. This is why we became doctors. We're here to help you. So never stop that. And I hope everyone does really well.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Next up is Isabel Blake, who is a heart failure nurse and mum of two. Her work usually takes place in the homes of her patients, and so therefore she is at increased risk. She doesn't have the same options of keeping the environment sterile that a lot of her hospital colleagues would, which can be really challenging. And one of the things I found most moving speaking to her, how that creates fear for her family. She's got two boys and she's got a mum who's part of a vulnerable category as well. And so trying to navigate doing the work she loves whilst also balancing the fear and the anxiety around bringing this disease home was really moving to her. Also, I should mention Isabel is a friend of Danielle's and that's how we got in touch with her. So do you want to mention anything about your friend?
Yay! Jarrett was amazing on the recording. I'm so proud of her. There's some really key, interesting points and actually said a few things that I didn't even know. So she spoke to you more than she'd told me and our friends some of that. And when we share this, I'm sure our friends will go, oh, we didn't probably realise how serious some of the feelings were that she had at the beginning, because she's the happiest person ever, so positive, and she just gets out and does her job every day. There's no moaning, there's no complaining ever. We complain so much more, and then we all check ourselves when we're on the phone to her and we're like, I'm having a shit week. And then Belle's like, really? But she never is. She's always the one listening and being happy to listen, knowing what she's going through. So yeah, I was really pleased that she got to be able to talk to you about that from an objective point of view, and I could hear and listen on to that. So yeah, really proud of her. Well done, Belle.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And she's such a classic example of nursing. I see that across the board, that priority on patients and putting others first and that real caring nature. It can't be faked. I think you either have it or you don't. So no, it was lovely getting to speak to her.
My name is Isabel Blake and I'm a community heart failure nurse specialist. My job entails seeing people with heart failure, and what I do is visit them at home, provide patient education, hospital avoidance. We run clinics, are basically just there to make sure the patients have a good journey in their heart failure status. How has the pandemic affected me at work? It's been such a journey. It's been scary. It's been challenging. It's been worrying. It's been adapting to change. It's learning to take things differently, like changing routine. I think initially at work, when we first found out about the pandemic, everyone was sort of like, oh my God, this is so scary. What are we doing? It was probably the first time in 13 years that I thought to myself, I can't do this. I can't do it. I thought, do you know what? I'll do anything. I don't want to be a nurse. I don't want to be a hero. I don't want to be on the front line. It's all very scary. Yeah, very scary.
And how did you find that affecting your personal life beyond work?
Do you know what? So at home, I've got two young boys. So obviously the main worry, I think, for me is bringing it home to my boys, bringing it home to my family. My mum's got dementia and I have to see her quite regularly. So I'm worried, am I a carrier? Have I got it? Am I going to bring it home to these innocent people that don't have a choice? Do you know what I mean? It's either, do I move out? They gave us the option to go and live in a hotel if you want to avoid, obviously, contaminating your family. That's one of the things that made me think, I didn't sign up for this. You know, I've got my children at home that don't have a choice in what mommy does, but they're so open to anything that I bring home to them, and that's the last thing that I'd want to do. So it's been hard. But yeah, you know, kids are amazing and they're resilient, aren't they? And they just kind of get on with it.
And I imagine there's something reassuring in that, because kids have a certain, like, almost fixed status that they're always just kind of doing their own thing. So potentially with everything else that's changed in your life, they still bring some normalisation.
My 9-year-old, he said to me one of the days, he said, Mum, I don't want you to go to work. He said, what if something happens to you? Because you're going to die. And I just thought, oh, Mummy's not going to die. Mummy's strong and Mummy's looking after people and Mummy's making sure people are, you know, and he kind of just thought about it for a second and then shrugged his shoulders and off he went. And I thought, God, if anything did happen to me, I've just kind of told this little boy that mommy's going to be fine, that it's going to happen. It's just awful to have to think that it's a reality. And the fact that he's thought about that, I don't know how much he's thought about it on his own or with his little brother, but just the fact that he said it to me, I was like, oh, it really took me.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it just shows that this reaches everyone. You know, you don't
absolutely think... you don't think, but I think you kind of think it's just surface with them. You don't actually think about how it's really affecting them inside. And the fact, like I said, the fact that he said that to him, I just thought, God, is he worrying at night time if I'm not coming home? Is he sat at home and I'm at work thinking, oh my God, what's mum doing? Is she coming home? So that's one of the hardest parts of it, I think, for me.
And in terms of your safety and trying to keep them safe, have you been able to get the PPE you need?
So the PPE we have now, up to date, is I think the most we're going to have. So we have gloves and aprons, surgical masks and visors or goggles. So that is what we wear into any patient, whether they're positive, non-positive, low risk, high risk. That's what we wear. That's for their protection as well as ours, really. But when we were going out first and we had like just a mask and we were told that that mask has got to last all day, whereas now we've got a mask that we can change in between patients. But, you know, I'd get home, well, I still do, get home from work, everything comes off, straight in the washing machine, I'm upstairs, straight in the shower, wash before I'll even hug the kids. You know, like they'll come running up to me to the door and I can't hug them. Or I don't want to touch them until I've been upstairs, stripped and had a shower. So, yeah, but, you know, any amount of PPE wouldn't change that, I don't think.
And in terms of your concerns of safety for you and your family, what is it that's kept you going?
Do you know what? It's because I absolutely, I love being a nurse. I just saw Dad's face and like, aww. But yeah, it's what I signed up for. And I love my job and I love looking after people. I love making sure they're okay. It's just kind of that get on with it and carry on culture, I think, that's kept me going. It's about having a good team at work. Everyone I work with is brilliant and we're all close anyway, but this has all really made us come together and just we can get through it. You feel like you can get through anything if you've got a good team behind you. So yeah, but it's been tough.
Yeah, I can certainly imagine that. And how are your patients responding to you still coming round and still being there, you know, for them?
All the patients that we go to see are actually really needed. So most of them are very grateful. I think the first visit that we did in full PPE, and they were like, oh, you know, should you be coming in and, you know, you could be passing it on. I said, I'm in the same boat. I said, I've got two young children at home. I've got a mum that's vulnerable. I could be passing it on to them. You could be giving it to me. Anyone can have it. Anyone can pass it to anyone. Just talking to people and making them understand that we need to be there.
And one thing that's been quite universal with healthcare professionals I've spoken to is that reiterating of we are doing everything we can to keep you safe.
Yeah. Our job, keeping you out of hospital, is so important.
And I'm so delighted that services like yours are still continuing and people are still getting the support out in the community when they need it at a time when there's so much focus on hospitals. But there are, at the same time, brilliant nurses like yourself all over the country in all kinds of settings.
That's it. You don't want to take anything away from the service that the hospital provides. It's vital. It's critical. Like you say, on the other hand, there are community nurses. There are care workers absolutely all doing their damnedest to keep people out of hospital and provide a good service at home.
Well, I think it's brilliant and I'm so glad that you're there doing what you do. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm proud, kind of just think to myself, Isabel, you're only human. You're allowed to be scared. You're allowed to be worried. You're allowed to have all of those feelings. But, you know, I just kind of push myself to go out and just treat it as like a normal day and get through it. And just thankful that every day I do get through it and proud to be a nurse and proud to be there for the NHS.
Next up is another previous guest and favourite of ours, Emma Carrington, who runs an essential service for supporting mental health. So right now, what she does has been very much pushed to the forefront, because when you're struggling to access other services, charities like Rethink Mental Illness get a massive influx in people asking for help. She also shares how, even with the challenges of her team working from home, they're still doing everything they can to support people. And like much of what we're discussing today, if you do want to learn more about Rethink Mental Illness, the details are in the episode description.
Hi, my name is Emma Carrington. I work for Rethink Mental Illness. We provide lots of services all across the country. But we have one national service called the Advice and Information Service that provides practical advice and information on mental health issues to anyone who is affected by mental illness, whether that's lived experience, caring for someone, friend, family, employers, all sorts of things. And we do that by email, phone, web chat and letter. So that's what I do.
Great. And how have you found the service has been impacted by the pandemic and the lockdown?
I mean, just kind of physically to start off with, we're a very small team and we work in a very small office in Birmingham, all used to kind of working in the same building. And now we all are having to work from home. I'm having to kind of get used to manage people remotely. I so take my hat off to people that do that because it's not as easy as you think it's going to be. So I personally am kind of dealing with that. I think for the staff, it's things like, and these are the kind of things I worry about for them, you know, that they're kind of answering calls from people that can be in some distress, who can be quite angry with the situations that they're in. And rather than being in an environment where we can all rally around them and make sure they're okay after a call, they're sitting in a room on their own and having to kind of deal with that. So that can be quite difficult for the team. And we're seeing a lot of change to the kind of calls that we're getting and the emails and things. So we're seeing a lot more people that are in distress and needing emotional support. That's not something that we do, but we do signpost to places like the Samaritans and Sane Line more so than normal. But also people who are kind of struggling to get the services that they need. My team will actually kind of talk to people about what their rights are, how COVID-19 might have changed those rights, or whether those rights are still there and you just have to kind of fight for them. And we can give them practical advice on how to go about doing that.
And with all these challenges, I find you personally really inspirational, but also the work you and your team do. Would you mind sharing what it is that keeps you going with all these challenges of supporting people, even when it's much more difficult to do so?
I think that, you know, Rethink as a whole, we care very much about, you know, mental health, obviously. We started out as a charity called the National Schizophrenia Fellowship. I'm so proud of this story. It was a guy called John Pringle. He'd got a family member with schizophrenia, and he was just shocked at how difficult it was to access services and things. And from that one letter, more people got in contact and our charity came out of that, which is just such an inspiring story, I think, that, you know, one person's letter can now lead to a national mental health charity being in place. I just absolutely love that. So, you know, we want to make sure that people with sort of severe mental illnesses do get their voices heard. And I think that all of us on the team, we all have different reasons for doing what we do. Myself, I feel very passionate about carers of people with mental illness. I think sometimes they are kind of forgotten and they do an absolutely amazing job. And I just want to always kind of be there for them because they're usually the ones that are fighting on behalf of their loved one, trying to get them the help and support that they need. So I'm really passionate about making sure that those people kind of get some support and know how to ask for what they need.
Brilliant. I love that. We were also delighted to be joined by Adi Raja, who spoke to us after just completing a 24-hour shift. He works as a junior doctor in acute medicine and has actually returned to work after dealing with COVID-19 himself, something that I found incredibly impressive. That with all the changes happening, with all the fear and anxiety, and then him getting the condition himself, as soon as he was well enough, as soon as it was safe to do, he was straight back onto the front line. I think like all of our key workers, it's just so admirable and it really makes me proud of the services that are out there. I'm really such a lovely part of the medical community that it is so team focused. It's about supporting each other as well as, of course, the patients.
So hi, my name is Adi Raja and I'm a frontline junior doctor. Currently, I work in the Princess Grace Hospital, which is a small independent hospital in central London. And I work in the Department of Acute Medicine, which is my main interest and specialty. But now, since coronavirus has hit, my role has completely changed. And we are now working very much in a surgical environment and providing the urgent operations that are needed for NHS patients.
Right. And do you mind sharing what kind of operations those are?
So we are one of the cancer surgical hubs for London. So we are treating the patients who unfortunately have been diagnosed with cancer and they require some sort of urgent operation to help remove the tumour for either relief of symptoms or curative treatment.
Right. And so since the pandemic has started, a lot of these additional patients are being passed to yourselves whilst NHS services try to keep up with the COVID demand. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So we are trying to be one of the so-called clean hospitals. So we are trying to remain coronavirus free. And so we're now completely under the umbrella of the NHS. So we've essentially stopped all of our private services. And we are taking on patients from various trusts across London. So we now have a flow of patients coming from all sides of London. And we are providing operations for a variety of tumours done by surgeons from across Greater London. And yeah, so we're trying to just remain as one of the clean sites because obviously, you know, it's important for these patients who are, you know, immunosuppressed from their diseases to obviously not catch coronavirus. Of course, the odd positive patient pops up and then we then somehow have to manage that in terms of whether we proceed with the operation or unfortunately we have to turn them away and bring them back or think about transferring them to one of the other NHS trusts.
I see. And so in terms of all these major changes, how's that impacted your work day to day?
It's completely different now. So we were a nice, small, little private hospital treating medical patients. And now we have suddenly turned into this big NHS centre. So it's very strange because, you know, I never would have imagined this would be occurring in this building, for example, because a lot of these private hospitals aren't built like NHS hospitals. Yeah, it's been a challenge. And when it all sort of kicked off, I actually contracted coronavirus myself and was off sick for a few weeks. And when I returned to work, a lot of the senior doctors and a lot of the managers were off sick. So I find myself, you know, figuring out the logistics of how we're going to bring the patients in, how we're going to set up a brand new ward, how we're going to train the doctors in a different way to now treat surgical patients. So major transformation. And we literally had to figure things out on the go and just create pathways in the matter of a couple of weeks. So yeah, it's been interesting, but it's been quite a challenge.
Wow, I can imagine. And do you mind me asking, in terms of you contracting COVID yourself, how that impacted you and maybe the people you live with?
Yes. So just before the pandemic hit, I felt myself feeling a bit run down. And I honestly would have just thought it was just nothing major at all. But my hospital was offering tests at the time. So I thought I'd get a test and it came back positive. And my symptoms weren't too severe. I had like a sore throat, runny nose, and a lot of fatigue. It was the fatigue that mainly stopped me from getting back to work. But it didn't affect anyone. So I live alone in a flat. I was stuck on my own suffering with these symptoms. But eventually I got better and then got back to work. And I have to say, I think I was quite relieved when I got back to work. It was nice to actually go in and do something. I did feel very guilty, I think, for not being on the sort of front line. I felt sort of guilty for not being there with my colleagues and doing something. But I think once we got back to work and once we started sort of creating these NHS services, I certainly felt a lot more sane, I'd say.
That's good to hear. And so now that you're back into work and it sounds like you're doing an incredible job coping with these really difficult changes, how are you finding you and your team are coping?
I think we really struggled initially. There was a lot of uncertainty around job roles, around who was going to work where. We had some complex surgical patients who were going to come in and, you know, we're all working out of our comfort zone. So I think there was a lot of anxiety around our roles and responsibilities. And then, you know, but then we had a call out for the Nightingale and we had a lot of volunteers for that, you know, because I think people felt like they wanted to go on the sort of so-called front line, although we are essentially on the front line. But I think now we've sort of gotten into the swing of things and we've got the right expertise, you know, on site and helping us. And we're doing some really good work. So it feels like a positive situation now. I think with uncertainty, you always sort of have a bit of anxiety. But I think ultimately now that we know we're doing great work and we're in the flow of things, we're sort of feeling pretty good about it.
Brilliant. That's great to hear. All right, we'll wrap up there then. Thank you. Now our penultimate guest, Camilla, she is a good friend of mine. She's a fellow Time to Change champion and she works in a supermarket. In this clip, she shares the impact of panic buying and the anxiety that this caused, not only for people doing the panic buying, but also those working in the supermarket industry. Also, the changes to keep customers safe, and overall how the public's attitude has changed towards her work, her industry and her colleagues. I was really delighted to share her experience working in what is such a key industry, but one that is so often overlooked.
Hi, I'm Camilla. I work for a smaller supermarket chain. The other week we had about 5,000 people come through our store. The challenges that we faced in terms of people panic buying and interruptions in our supply chain, the difficulties in keeping people apart and safe while they're shopping. It has been really tricky, but we're getting through it. Our supply chain interruptions have been sort of worked out, and our employers are generally looking after us pretty well in terms of sending down the PPE. It took a while, but we're getting there. Stock is getting on the shelves, and people's attitudes have changed slightly, being appreciated a lot more now. We did have some difficulty with, you know, customers not understanding how the supply chain works and how difficult it is to get stuff on the shelves when we're trying to keep away from everybody and keep you all safe. But things are returning to normal a little bit better now. And thank you to all the people who stopped for a second and said, we appreciate you and you're doing a great job, because it means an awful lot to us. Particularly the random acts of kindness that I've seen, you know, people sharing their baby milk or their toilet paper or anything like that. It just gives a feeling of hope, and it's really good for us to see that human kindness to, you know, people who are elderly, people who work in the NHS, the clapping, the appreciation. It's really heartwarming for us to see behind the till, and it's great to see people being good to each other and sticking to the rules, because ultimately that's what's going to bring us through this.
Yeah, very true. And are you finding the panic buying is sort of resolving itself at this point?
Now that people can see that the shelves are pretty full, they're not feeling the need to grab two or three of everything. I won't have to stop anybody buying 12 packets of rice anytime soon. I think people have been made aware things are slowly but surely they will return back to normal. Yeah.
Good. Your little facial expressions. And are you finding as the conversation continues, people are more understanding and respectful of the distancing and the limiting of number of people in stores?
Yes, I find if anything, they're starting to police each other. Like, excuse me, would you go and stand over there with a little on the floor? We've had very clear social distancing measures put in place at our store, so we can see if people aren't sticking to it. But I think people are more aware now of the fact that they're putting us at risk as well. They're trying to stay away from us, you know, pay contactless and stand as far away as possible while they're being served. I think things are changing. The conversation has changed. It's not just about panic now. It's about protection and knowing that they're taking care of us as we're trying to take care of them.
And with all the understandable concern in your industry, not just from a stock point of view, but from obviously the health point of view, how have you managed anxiety around being in work and being around so many people that could have symptoms and not even know it?
I think ultimately you have to put your faith in the PPE and the measures that have been sent down to you from head office. They have been thought through very well. And I've been lucky in the sense that I can trust the people that I work for to think of me. I'm aware that that is not the case for everybody. So I'm trying to just stick to the rules and just stay grateful that I have a job where I can know what I'll be paid next month and I can feel comfortable that way. And to know that things are changing and people's attitudes are changing. And people are just much more grateful now. It makes it so much easier to do my job and keep that anxiety at bay. People are sticking to the procedures. And the more that they do that, the less time that this will go on for.
No, that's so true. And do you feel a sense of pride in the role that you do now and being able to contribute in such a way that maybe at times people didn't appreciate in the past?
I do. I think working in a supermarket is such an odd job. It's not terribly well thought of, but at times like this, with, as I said, the appreciation, you know, people have been like buying us flowers and writing us thank you cards, and it changes your perspective on who you are, and it makes you feel like you're worth it, like you're worth being protected and being praised, like you provide a great service and an essential service. And I think I've started to realise that about my job too.
Yeah, you and your colleagues are doing such a brilliant thing, and I'm so glad that there's people like you out there keeping an eye on us, keeping the stores tidy and stocked so that we can more safely live as normal lives as possible.
Thank you. It's great to be able to talk things through and remind people that we are getting there and getting what people need as safely as possible, so we can continue to just provide a great service to people as we've always done, as we always will do. Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you. Last up, we were delighted to be joined by Pierce Harrison-Reed, who's an A&E nurse and shared what he is doing to reassure patients and build rapport, even with the limitations PPE can create for communication. He also talks stigma in the NHS. He's also an incredible poet who updated a piece he did for the NHS's 70th birthday recently to reflect the current challenges, but also the hope and the renewed appreciation for the NHS. This has been shared widely, including by the BBC, and in just a matter of weeks, gained 500,000 views.
It was brilliant that we had him on the show, wasn't it? And I just think that I wasn't surprised how well he spoke and how insightful he was.
He's an incredibly articulate guest, and it was lovely that even with the distancing and us having to interview our guests over digital means at the moment, that none of his passion was lost. And you'll hear that both in the following clip and also his reading of the poem, which will close out today's special episode. So with that all said, here's Piers, and thank you to him and all our incredible frontline workers for keeping us all safe, well, fed, and as mentally healthy as would be possible right now.
So I'm Piers Harrison-Reed. I'm an A&E nurse. I've been working in A&E for the past 4 years, so I've been in there a lot since coronavirus started. It's kind of affected my role quite gradually, really. I think I was one of the people who started being aware of it potentially affecting the way that we organized A&E quite early on. And I felt like I was a bit more open-eyed about it than some of my colleagues who were trying to pretend it wouldn't affect us. But gradually, despite what people expected, it's taken on more and more of a role within our day-to-day lives. And we've had to organize our daily shifts, but also the physical space we operate in quite differently to when we started.
And with all these changes at work, how has that affected home and your own health potentially?
I think I'm in a very privileged position from a mental health perspective. I've definitely felt that my mental health has been worse since COVID started, but I have dealt with previous mental health crises, both of my own and people that I was very close to when I was quite young. So I feel like I'm relatively resilient mentally now. And that's partly been because of my writing and my creative expression. I feel like I'm able to process quite complex emotions now much better than I was able to when I was young. So I think with all this stuff, because it's a macro thing, it's such a big change for so many people, I think it's not something which I take personally, which I think is really important. And I think the changes that I've had to make in my personal life have been relatively small in comparison to other people's. So realistically, I'm just trying to make sure that I do all the real basic things that we know are good for us mentally, you know, eating well, going out and exercising, really focusing on spending time with my friends, even if it's through a screen. And both me and my girlfriend, because we work in the same place and we have a good understanding of the amount of stress we take on daily, I think we were able to give each other enough space to process, but also give each other a way of feeding back and venting, which is really important after a really long shift. So I think I haven't had to change that much in order to deal with the complexity of the coronavirus crisis personally. It's just all been in my professional life, to be honest. I've been continuing that with hopefully good habits that I've already got into. So.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're really making the most of it not changing as much at home, given how drastically everything's changing at work.
For sure, for sure. And I think I've been very lucky in that. I think partly, I used to do a lot of sport, team sports when I was able to. So I think that's the big thing which has changed, as well as not being able to perform as much. But because so much of health and fitness can be done, you know, in the home, doing exercise or going out for independent runs, and so much creative expression can be done, especially from a poetic point of view. It doesn't have to be done in a group. It doesn't have to be done in front of people. The way you process your emotions is still a very personal thing. So I've just been lucky in the things that which I've chosen to spend my time doing through my life just so happened to concord quite well with coronavirus. So I know a lot of my friends in the creative sphere have really struggled because a lot of their creation and performance is so interwoven in how they see themselves. So it's been really tough for people who have creative expression is their primary source of income, but also their primary, you know, use of their time. So,
right, yeah, you certainly have many advantages in your type of creativity, but I don't know if I'd say lucky, maybe, because you've clearly been proactive with your mental health.
Yeah, for sure. But I think I've learned over the years that I think you do have to be quite proactive with the way you kind of see yourself and the way you process your emotions. I grew up in a place in Suffolk which was relatively sleepy, and I had a big group of male friends who were all associated by our mutual love for heavy metal music, essentially. And I think inside of that culture, there is a lot of like hypermachismo and a lot of people who don't really process their emotions very well. And we go through life within those groups sometimes, you know, associating very strongly with that one thing, but not necessarily allowing ourselves to grow and really pick apart the things which make us who we are. And so I think that allows a certain amount of laziness, which then can kind of mutate into some quite negative emotions moving forwards. And I think that I was quite lucky to come at it from a kind of an outside perspective, because I moved down from Sheffield when I was quite young, and feel like I could always hold myself to account if I felt like I was processing things in a negative way. And I know a few of my friends are still struggling with processing emotions in a way which isn't kind of still informed by that hypermechismo background, and sometimes which is quite negative, but in a way you don't see how negative it is until you're already quite far down the toxic kind of pathway that you're on.
Yeah, that is a really universal struggle, and one that I think when you've gone through your own difficulties, you're so much more tuned in with others. How are you finding your colleagues are coping?
I think it's difficult to know other people's struggles from the outside. And I don't think that inside of healthcare, even though you'd expect a lot of people would be very happy to share, because we see stressful things day in, day out, I think there is still an issue within healthcare that we don't want to burden other people we work with our personal troubles, and we don't necessarily want to become a patient. So I think some people do have a tendency to let the stress levels get really bad before they seek help. And for fear of other people judging them, it still happens in the health service. I think people are still afraid that by acknowledging that they feel mentally unwell or mentally unstable, then other people we work with might think of them as lesser, even if we've got quite a lot of experience dealing with people who have mental health crises from a caregiver perspective. I think we still sometimes don't expect people will be understanding. So I think there's a lot of people who probably are struggling but don't share that much, unfortunately.
Right. And that's the difficulty, isn't it? That it's such a personal journey that I'm sure your colleagues would never refer to a patient as being a burden for their mental ill health, but they would project that on themselves potentially.
For sure.
And in terms of being proactive then, more as a team and a workplace, how are you finding people supporting each other?
I certainly think that A&E is a strange place. We're very task focused because we have targets to hit to try and get people through our system and into places where they can seek ongoing help. And I think that isn't necessarily an easy place to support each other in a very holistic way. But I think that because we're all very task focused, we're able to support each other in a very task focused way and get through the working day, but without necessarily being able to properly chat and unpick any ongoing issues with each other, because we're all very busy all the time when we're at work. So I think it's something which I think there's a sense of camaraderie and there's a sense of kind of team working for the betterment of the department, but I don't necessarily think it allows us as much space to really connect and support each other in ways other areas do.
Yeah. And so with all these challenges in mind, is there a positive that's really coming through from your work, or maybe how the patients have been? Is there a hope you're drawing from it?
Yeah. I think it's early on in the crisis, there was certainly a lot more of an appreciation that was shown by the patients. And I think there was a lot more of a understanding that the health service isn't something that should be squandered. It's something which is very precious. I think we're seeing a bit of a change now as the virus progresses and as our response to it progresses, that people are starting to take less ownership of their own health again, I think, and are a bit more likely to come in with high expectations. But I think that happens as people are in lockdown for such a long time, that it's kind of expected that they would start to maybe lose a little bit of the positive community action that was associated with Clap for Carers, because we're all, I think, getting a little bit tired of lockdown. So I kind of understand that. But I think over the course of it, there has been so much wonderful support from everybody. You know, I've had people stop me in the street and be really supportive if I've been wearing anything even remotely associated with the NHS. I've got into contact with so many people around my local community who know we work as NHS nurses who've given us presents, and they've been really, really, you know, positive and happy to talk to us about how much they appreciate the NHS, which is really nice to see. I really hope that kind of positivity continues moving forwards. And I think it would be really nice to see if that positivity, if we're able to harness it and move forwards to try and improve the NHS in the next few years to hopefully deal with the next pandemic, because there will unfortunately be others after this. So hope we learn.
Yeah, for sure. Last question then. In terms of the limitations that PPE can put on communication, you are more covered up in your role than ever before. How are you managing to still connect with the patients and support them beyond just, you know, the purely scientific level?
That is a very, very good question. I think it depends. So we use quite different levels of PPE depending on what area we're in. So we have, I kind of talked about that we split our department into multiple areas, and they're color-coded to mean whether or not somebody is likely to have COVID-19, definitely has COVID-19, or is unlikely to have COVID-19, essentially. And in our very serious room in A&E called the resuscitation suite, the one in the yellow area, so people who are likely to have COVID-19, we have the full PPE. So we wear visors, we wear very tight-fitting FFP3 masks, and we wear quite a lot of kind of baggy gowns. Restricts our movement, but also it's very difficult to understand what people are saying, and there's almost... it kind of restricts your body language and your facial expressions quite substantially. Now, the people inside that room are almost universally quite unwell. So our communication with those people is minimal at the best of times because they're quite focused on how unwell they feel. And we're quite focused on being very task specific. But also people sometimes, when they come in acutely unwell with COVID-19, they sometimes are quite confused. And we also have a lot of people who, especially earlier on in the crisis, were coming in from care homes, potentially with quite complex cognitive issues, which meant actually you'd really want them to be able to see your face so you can communicate as best as possible with someone who's quite confused. But obviously that's not really a possibility. So for most people, it's just shouting over the noise of the area. But for those people, I think it's quite difficult to get any kind of compassionate, caring communication through to them, because if you're already confused, you don't want to see somebody who looks quite alien to you coming and stabbing you with needles. And that's a very difficult thing to, I don't think there's an easy way of initiating conversation in a caring way with all that stuff on. Whereas other areas, we're using just a mask really and just apron and gloves. So it's much easier to just take time to slowly speak to people and make sure they understand you fully. And I think a lot of us have practiced doing eye smiles, which are just smiling just with your eyes so that people understand that what you're saying is meant is a kind thing, which is very difficult to do when you've got a mask on. It's quite difficult to smile with just your eyes, but I've been practicing in the mirror, so hopefully it's getting across.
That's lovely. Grand. All right, so we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much.
No worries whatsoever. Hopefully you get something which is useful for this wonderful show. I've been listening to a few episodes and it seems like you guys are doing a really good job. I think especially destigmatizing mental health for healthcare workers for one, but also young men, is super important to me. And it's something which I've been meaning to write about at length for quite a while. So yeah, keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that sounds like another collaboration right there.
Yeah, for sure. I've written about mental health in young men quite a few times, but it's always felt like it's been as a part of a story as opposed to the focus of it. So I'd like to write something which is very acutely about mental health.
Brilliant. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
NHS. He's still somehow one of the most efficient health systems in the world, the jewel in our crown. But all trophies atrophy and your eyes look tired. You're not sleeping quite as well as you used to. At 27, I've seen too many people die. But you've seen so many live to transcend sickness. Your walls have weaved so many stories. And there's still a glint in your eyes, I can see it. And your heart still beats multicultural and myogenic in its magnificence. But we're scared of the imagery. The wartime reporting propaganda already painting our leaders as legends, unashamedly shifting the blame and aiming to normalize the dead. They're not keeping count or saying our names aloud, but we died doing something we loved, so they can applaud. Before avoiding tough questions about how many are gone, We appreciate the public. We really, really do. Our love is driven by their incredibly kind words and our times of darkness, but love, unsupported, can only go so far. All the free stuff fails without funding. All the applause is empty without proper protection from the virus that is ravaging our ranks. We may be brave, but underpaid. Overworked, so disengaged, disrespected, disempowered, and vilified with our defiance devoured, and they have the gall to tell us not to make this political. NHS, all of this is political. Your arms are refuge. The taxes they took should be your lifeblood, but you're anemic, hypovolemic. And though these Brexit and COVID wounds may heal, we'd never survive losing you. And I'm tired. My skin worn raw from the mass I'm lucky to even have. I've been spat on and shouted at, and I don't feel brave. My sanity saved when I can see your faces. And my sanity saved when I see your faces. NHS, your staff are beautiful. Their masks off and their smiles sparkling in the sun. So this is a love poem to you, to us, NHS. All this bursting, fizzing, caring love. Quiet, hand-holding love, studious, dedicated, time-consuming, all-consuming love. And love is for the brave. And I know we too can transcend this sickness.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.